Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here, so much more importantly, the author of 11 books and counting. She's done so much, part of a continuing series, more books to come, but also a documentary to come. And during a time of crisis, this wonderful woman has gotten a lot done. I got to say, it's inspirational how much she has done while most people are paralyzed by this situation. Dr. Florence Byam Weinberg is our very special guest. If you go to iHeartRadio.com and maybe about 15 other places and counting, Deezer, I think, is a new opening for the series. I never even heard of Deezer, I got to say, and I say that respectfully, but you can go to Deezer and listen to the doctor there and everything that we've been doing here. So binge listen to everything we've been doing. Frank McKay here. Welcome. Welcome, Doc.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, well, listen, thrilled to have you. And we were just talking a little off mic about Toastmasters, and that's something we both have in common. And for those who don't know, I once said to someone when they asked, what is Toastmasters? And I said, it's almost like a 12-step program for public speakers. And I don't know that's over or understating it, but it really is terrific. And if folks don't know about Toastmasters, it is all over the place. It is Toastmasters International, and it is some place that you can go and you could work on your public speaking skills. Dr. Weinberg is someone who's done, you know, quite a bit of public speaking as an educator and as an author, but still she continues to go to Toastmasters, which I think is absolutely terrific. What, how can you sum up Toastmasters better than I just did?
It was a friend of mine who was a theater director on the high school and college levels, and in her retirement she decided that she would keep up her speaking skills, and so she joined Toastmasters, and that particular chapter had an open house, and she invited me to go, and I went, and I was amused and impressed and decided it would be good for me, too, so I've been in it ever since. So I've been a Toastmaster now probably about 10 years.
Yeah, see, it's terrific. It gives you a lot of confidence. There's something that, and I don't know, I'm sure it's the same format everywhere, but there was something called Table Topics when I was involved. And
it's still there, yes.
Yeah, and they have an awe counter. So in other words, every time you do a filler word or a filler syllable, they'll count it, and it's not to, you know, be critical. It's to point out to you, oh, you had 11 ahs, or you had 11 ums, or something like that. And they used to, the group that I was involved with was a bunch of scientists. And the reason I went there in the first place is because I thought there would be a lot of foreign speakers there. And early on, and I guess this is about 20-something years ago, 25 years ago or something, and I figured if you're going to go to a place and you're going to work out speeches and you're nervous about it, why not go where there's a bunch of people that that English is not their first language? And because it's really just about getting up there yourself and going in front of folks. And also I figured that they would be more understanding of someone coming there learning. So I joined this small group. It was a lunchtime group at B&L Labs, Brookhaven National Labs, which is a, you know, internationally known, laboratory. And when I went there, I was, you know, it was very successful for me. It was a tremendous experience, and I stayed involved and loved the experience. But again, you're listening to Dr. Florence Byam Weinberg, everyone, and she is the author of so many books. Binge listen to everything we've been doing. Go to iHeartRadio.com. But your immediate experience with it, you were just trying to stay sharp. You weren't trying to get over a phobia or
no
nerves or anything like that. You didn't have that issue.
Well, in a way, I always have had. Certainly in the first two or three meetings with a class, I would have butterflies. And certainly in faculty meetings and all of that sort of thing, you have to do a lot of speaking before critical eyes and ears. And so I have had issues with shyness, and I still do. It's funny, but I still do. Anyway, I thought I would probably get over it, and I haven't. I am much better at not saying ah, which I just did, in the middle of something, in order to fill a vacant space, and much better in formulating my thoughts, because Toastmasters will tell you that in order to make a speech, you have to start off telling the audience what you're going to tell them, and then you tell them what you have to say, and then you sum it up in the end by retelling what you just said. And that way, you teach them something. They really do learn it, because they've heard it in three different ways: the preview, the actual, and the conclusion. So it's a way to organize things much more succinctly and better than you've ever done it before, if you're just winging it the way most professors are, because there's no actual training for getting up in front of a class. You just have to do it and teach yourself, which is funny, strange in a way, I find, because communication is the basis of education.
Yeah.
And Toastmasters certainly teaches you how to do that.
Tremendous organization. No question. And the purpose is wonderful. And one of the, you know, I recommend it to anyone who has that issue. I was wondering, I didn't know anything about it. And I was actually thinking of going to some kind of self-help group. This is, you know, 25 years ago when I had been elected to a political office. And I had to give a speech in front of 500 people. And some of them antagonistic, some of them supportive, some of them. So I needed to go, and I was nervous, and I never gave a speech before. I never did anything like that. And once I started asking around, where can I go? What kind of place can I do this at? And I was thinking of showing up at a, you know, some kind of trauma meeting. And it sounds so disrespectful, but to say, oh, you know, I had a problem, and kind of make up something. My brother said to me, just go to Toastmasters. And I said, what's Toastmasters? And he explained, and I looked it up, and sure enough, it was a prominent situation. You mentioned something else right before we jumped on air. You mentioned another group that you're working with on Zoom, where your meetings are curtailed because of the pandemic, but you did another group meeting. What was it that you were mentioning? Do you remember?
Well, yes, it was the Daedalus Literary Critique Group, which is a group of six people who are all writers, and we all happen to be prose writers, and we all are fiction writers, or one of us is doing, let me see how to express it. She is doing more history and other reporting type writing. She wrote a history of her town, which is Helotes, Texas. And then she did another history of Helotes, Texas in photographs. And then she did a report on a murder that took place in 1898 or so of a Texas Ranger by another Texas Ranger. And it was a mystery, and she traced it all down and wrote a book about it. And I don't think it's been published yet. I'm not positive about that. But in any case, it's published. It's called Death of a Texas Ranger, in case you are interested, by Cynthia Leal Massey, M-A-S-S-E-Y, Cynthia Leal, L-E-A-L, Massey. And she traced everything. And, of course, since I know Spanish very well, and the murderer crossed the border into Mexico and was tried down there and convicted and imprisoned.
It's okay. Let me remind folks. Let me just remind folks at this point, Dr. Florence Byham Weinberg is our very special guest. And she should grab a cup of water. You're going to scare the audience.
Yes, I've got one right here.
Especially with the pandemic, they're going to be concerned that you're not feeling well. Have you been out much during this last week
or
so?
I haven't been out for days, and I'm out of food. I've got to, and my cats are out of food too. And I'm more worried about them than I am about me.
So, I mean, what do you do? What do you do in a situation? Don't you have delivery service? H-E-B, right? H-E-B is the...
H-E-B is the big grocery store in San Antonio. It began here and is spreading throughout the south of Texas. Hasn't gotten up to Dallas yet.
In Houston, I went to an H-E-B, and it was the big store around the area.
Yes, right. Southern Texas, and that includes Houston, and that's really a big deal for them to have stores in Houston.
Yeah.
And all the smaller towns like New Braunfels and Austin, all of them have H-E-B grocery stores. Anyway, so I get my food there, and I go to CVS for my prescriptions and other drugstore needs. And those are the two places I've been, really. So church was open yesterday for the first time, but I didn't go. I was afraid that since the governor has opened up Texas and supposedly everything is permitted now, I was worried that people would go too far and that friends would be coming right up to me and hugging me and that sort of thing, and that shouldn't be allowed. It really shouldn't be allowed because the church is one place where there have been many cases of COVID-19 contagion, and some of them have opened up and had to close up again. So anyway, I didn't go yesterday.
You know, I've got to say, in the last time I went to a Catholic mass was right before the pandemic, and it was for a funeral service, unfortunately. And I saw so many people drinking out of the chalice, and I thought to myself, this is before the pandemic. I hadn't even heard about COVID-19. But I thought to myself, boy, that's, you know, when during the communion, that's the last thing in the world I would want to do is drink out of that chalice. And people are fearless about it, or were. I don't think they will be doing that or allowing that anymore. But people would drink out of the chalice just historically without thinking anything of it. I always thought it was a little cavalier.
Me too. I've always worried about it because it's obviously the best way in the world to catch something. And I have caught colds that way, I'm sure. So, yes, I think it would be much better to have communion by intinction. You know what that is, Frank?
No. What is that?
That's when the priest dips the wafer in the wine and then puts it on your tongue. And of course, that would mean that if he is contaminated, if he has COVID-19, he would be passing it easily that way.
Wow.
But
I should know that. I'm a former altar boy. I should have known that word.
Yeah, intinction. Anyway, that's slightly more sanitary than drinking out of the same cup. But the Protestants have these little glasses. little trays of tiny, tiny little glasses, each one filled And, of course, they use grape juice because they don't believe in alcohol at all. And they don't, when you ask them why grape juice when Jesus turned the water into wine, and they say, well, they didn't know any better back then.
That's interesting. Wow. Again, Dr. Florence Byham Weinberg is the person that you're listening to. Binge listen to everything that we've done. And again, like it might be 15 or more outlets, including iHeartRadio, you can go to binge listen to the continuous series here with me, Frank McKay. Let me ask you, going back to the public speaking, the first time that you had to give a talk on one of your books, and again, this is different, even though, well, I would assume it's a different experience, because you had all this experience teaching up in Rochester all those years and other places, and you taught at the college level, so you're not, you know, you're not in front of a bunch of kids, you're in front of adults that are educated folks, and they're, you know, they could be critical, you know, they could be judgmental, they could be whatever. So you have a tremendous amount of experience speaking in public. But is it different taking that experience and applying it to a book that you wrote that you're now speaking in front of somebody about?
Yes, it's different, but in both cases, you've got material that you know well to talk about. If it's your own book, you know it like the back of your hand or the palm of your hand, whichever. And so it's relatively easy to talk about your own book. You do have to organize your thoughts and be sure that you get one incident before the other in order and so forth. In other words, you have to organize your speech just as you did if you were presenting material for a class. So I would say that it's roughly the same, except that you really have your own interests at heart when you're talking about your own book.
You know, the interesting thing to me is that you're afforded a lot of leeway when you're talking about your own book. In other words, people will yield to you. Oh, well, it's not like she's interpreting or he's interpreting Freud, and, you know, everyone has different opinions. This is the author of the book that's telling, you know. So you have that kind of, forgiveness. If there's something that doesn't sound right, they can shrug their shoulders and say, hey, you know what, that's the author of the book. I have a different experience, and I won't deviate too much here, but I mentioned to you, I think off mic, that you know, I've written a bunch of books as well, and
right,
several of them, I should say two of them, are books that I completed of my father's, and he was a baseball wizard. I mean, he knew statistics and trivia inside and out, and we, you know, completed a couple of books. When I say we, my brother and I completed a couple of his books posthumously. So he was, you know, he's the author of three books now instead of one. And I was so concerned once when I had to go in front of a pretty big crowd and they were baseball fanatics that they were going to throw questions at me as if I'm this trivia expert and whatever. And I said to myself before I went in, I said, if they throw something at me that I just have no idea about, I'm going to say, look, the man who did this research is not with us any longer, and he'd be able to answer all of these questions or whatever. We compiled his information. You know, I had a pat answer to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very helpful to do. And I think something like that came up, and I said it, and I think people appreciated it. You know, they kind of chuckled in appreciation and it would, I don't know, even gave me a pass. I don't even know that they looked at it like that, but it was something that was very acceptable to say under those circumstances.
Absolutely. And honest and straightforward, and people appreciate that very much. And besides that, you probably know a heck of a lot about baseball yourself.
Yeah.
Even though you don't have the depth of of lore that your father did, nonetheless, I bet you could have answered many of those questions.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And, you know, one of the other things, I mean, while we're on the subject, and if we've piqued anyone's interest about Toastmasters, I would encourage everyone to that needs to work on a skill or sharpen a skill to go to Toastmasters and do that. But one of the things that I learned through politics and in the entertainment business, we managed some famous people, and, you know, I used to do 100 questions with them or 200 questions. And basically that was just a little exercise we created where we'd ask them 100 questions over a course of a few days or whatever, where they wouldn't be shocked if they heard it from a reporter and maybe an antagonistic reporter. And so we would throw that out there, and anything we could think of that we could throw at him or her that they're going there. And one of the things that we always said is that you don't necessarily have to answer the question. You talk about what you feel like talking about. You stay on message, especially if you're on television. Mm-hmm. If you're on television, you only have a couple of minutes. And unless that reporter really wants an answer to that question, you could give them something of a substitute and get away with it. And they've got a time limit. They've got to get you off. So if you fill up the time with what you want to be on air, then, you know, it's perfectly okay. What have you learned over the course of time with either Toastmasters or in schooling that you can kind of impart to folks that you think would be helpful for them with either public speaking or teaching or writing for that matter? What do you have to add to that?
Well, I'll talk about Toastmasters first, anyway. And that is, there is a segment of each meeting which is called Table Topics.
Right.
And Table Topics are topics that they're timed, and I think it's 2 minutes long. You have 2 minutes, and you just said that this is true of television, that you need to answer within 2 minutes. And these are questions that the topics master has a set of questions that you know nothing of, so it's sprung on you. And for instance, I was once asked the question: you have a fountain or a well. I think he said you have a well at your home, and it has certain qualities. Talk to us about this well in the yard of your home. So I talked about a secret garden and a well, which was the fountain of eternal youth. And I enlarged on that fairy tale topic, and of course I won the prize that day. But it means these questions can be something about world politics. They can be about anything at all. And you then have to step up to the plate and take a shot at answering the question. But as you say, Frank, you don't have to answer the question. If you don't know anything about it, for instance, if somebody asked me something about a Beatles song, comment on Diamonds in the Sky or something,
right,
I wouldn't have the foggiest idea how to answer that, and I would have to talk about something else.
Right.
And so then it's up to you to pick something else that may be obliquely about the subject or maybe not at all, and say, well, your question reminds me and then go on with something else.
Yeah.
And that is allowed in Table Topics. Usually you won't win the Table Topics prize for that meeting, but at least you will have gotten through those 2 minutes.
You know, it's terrific. I mean, that's a wonderful example of what Toastmasters does. It's tremendous. Frank McKay here once again with Dr. Florence Byham Weinberg. and she's the author of 11 books, soon to be the subject of a documentary. More books on the way. Her memoir is the big one. I think that's going to be the granddaddy or the grandmama of them all, and this is going to be a must. And it's I think it's the book that'll put everything in perspective. And 100 years from now, when people I know are reading these books and understanding, and maybe there's a complete understanding at that point of Ignaz Pfefferkorn, I don't know. I don't think there's any more information coming out on him unless something, unless you or me, you and I find it somehow here in our lifetime. I'm not sure that there's going to be too much more on Pfefferkorn coming out, but the all...
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, the go-to person is going to be you or a Wikipedia page or whatever is left. And the interesting thing about that is in all of those books, someone could ask you about Pfefferkorn. There's a very good chance that no one knows who he is in the audience. And you're introducing, just like you introduced to me, who Pfefferkorn was, for the first time they're understanding this individual. So you have a responsibility, in a sense, but you also have a lot of leeway.
Indeed, yes. And the Germans actually recognized that, and they invited me. His ancestors all lived in a town called Siegburg, which is close to Cologne. And it was Siegburg. Well, he went there to die. He spent the last few years of his life there in what had been his family's hometown. And he died and was buried there. And so Siegburg has the pride of knowing that. But oddly enough, they had dug up the graveyard around the cathedral, or around the church. I don't think it's a cathedral, but huge, beautiful 13th century church. And they moved the graveyard out of town, and they only moved the important people, the people they considered important, to the new site, and then they paved over what had been the graveyard. Pfefferkorn, unfortunately, was not known well enough. This was, of course, done in the 20th century, and he was simply not known well enough, so they left him there, and he is now buried under a bunch of paving stones. And when I was there, the first time I went there, I went and bought a rose, a red rose, and laid it on the paving stones near the door to the cathedral, or the church, to commemorate my friend Pfefferkorn and to honor him. And then they turned around and invited me to give a speech about him. And so I did. I gave a speech telling them who he was and what he had accomplished, and told them that they at least should put up a bronze plaque commemorating him. And, of course, they haven't done it, but I was recommending it. And it made a bit of a splash at the time. That was about 4 years ago now. So so that was Pfefferkorn.
Yeah. Wow.
And he was, for the people who haven't heard about him at all, he was a missionary, Jesuit missionary, in the Sonora Desert. So that's now part of northwestern Mexico, the most northwestern province in Mexico, or rather state. They're states now. And part of Arizona as well. And it's a large area, and the Jesuits were in charge of it for quite a few years in the 18th century. And Pfefferkorn was there for 11 out of those years. And then he and all the Jesuits were arrested and exiled. And Pfefferkorn spent 10 years in prison, accused of having stolen the gold of the Sonora mines. So briefly, that is Pfefferkorn, and I discovered him because he wrote a book about Sonora, and his personality comes through so clearly that I became intrigued with him and what he had done And it was so interesting, his take on Sonora, because he covered just about all the sciences that were not even named at the time he was there. They weren't named until the 19th century, and he was there until 1767. So he was a keen observer of nature. So he talked about the anthropology and biology, botany, geography, geology, entomology, and so on, without naming them, but simply talking about all those subjects in a very observant and clever way. And I thought he would make a terrific detective. He was such a good observer. And so I wrote all of the books about him in the form of murder mysteries.
Yeah, incredible. And, you know, if you think about it, he's a theologian, he's a musician, a Renaissance man, you know, really.
Yes, he was. He was a fine violin player, and that's how he converted the Indians. The Indians who were all hiding when he came to his first mission, because there had just been a revolt, and they had not the Indians that he was going to convert in that particular spot, but Indians in that region had killed one of the priests and had driven others out and so on. It was quite the thing. And the ones he was supposed to be in charge of hid because they were afraid of the escort of soldiers that he had with him. And they wouldn't come out, so he sent the soldiers away. And still they didn't come out. And he became very nervous. In order to console himself, he began to play his violin. And then he looked out the rectory window and saw that the Indians were all grouped around, and some of them were dancing to the music.
Wow.
And after that, they were very eager to learn what he knew, and of course they wanted to learn to play the violin also.
Which is complicated if you don't have a lot of violins.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, again, another reminder, Dr. Florence Byham Weinberg is our very special guest, part of a continuing series. iHeartRadio.com is a great place to go. Frank McKay here with Dr. Florence Byham Weinberg. The one thing that stands out to me after all of that, and I heard part of that before, but one thing that stands out to me is that in his hometown that he died in, the town that he went to die in, that he wasn't important enough to get moved. I wonder who was classified as important enough. If it wasn't Pfefferkorn, I imagine it's somebody who had rich relatives, right? Is who got moved, and that's probably what happened. And his relatives did not do well. Is that what it is?
Well, no, he was an old man. He actually died at 76, which was considered very old in those days. And he had been in prison and tortured in order to extract the information about the gold of the Sonora mines, which he didn't have. And he had malaria also. And so he had a lot of problems, health problems, and 76 was a pretty good age to achieve in
back
those
then.
Days.
Yeah,
and even in our day, with the kind of abuse his body had taken.
Yeah. Right.
So anyway, as an old fellow who was probably, he might have been saying mass every so often, but not regularly. And he was a modest individual. He didn't push himself. So I expect he wasn't universally known and celebrated. That was one thing. And he was not a major politician. He was not the mayor of the town or something other important, a wealthy person. And so he wasn't considered important. There you are. His family was not there, and so there was no big tombstone either. And I imagine the size of the tombstone was another marker for how important you were.
Do you imagine that humility played a part in Pfefferkorn not being as recognized as part? He wasn't a public relations man, if you think about it. He was, seemed committed to his goal and to his mission, you know, both figuratively and you know, and spiritually, to his mission. He doesn't seem like he was a public relations man, like Mark Twain,
right.
For example. Mark Twain was a public relations man. They,
mm-hmm.
you know,
oh,
they,
yeah.
they pointed out about his white suit, you know, that it wasn't just his taste. He would walk in that white suit and everyone would know, oh, that's somebody. Oh, that's Mark Twain right there and his mustache. And, you know, he was a public relations guy. He was a, you know, some people would say he was prone to gimmicks, someone
yes.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
you know. Picasso, in some ways, you know, Dali more, Salvatore Dali was a public relations
machine. Oh, yes,
machine.
Both of them, yes. Right.
Yeah. And Pfefferkorn was not, and maybe that's part of the reason that he's so hard to recognize is that he didn't blow his own horn, so to speak.
Exactly, exactly. And, of course, being a Jesuit, you wouldn't. I mean, he was trained to be modest and humble, and he was, although he had been vicar of a church in a neighboring town called Unkel, Unkel, and right on the Rhine, and so he was better known in Unkel than he was in Siegburg. But his ancestors, now his father, his grandfather had been mayor of the town of Siegburg and secretary to the Benedictine monastery, which is sort of like a medieval castle sitting on top of the hill. Siegburg is in a pyramid style. It's built around this conical hill. So the city is around the foot of the hill, the way medieval towns used to be around the castle, and the monastery is way up top. And so it sort of ruled the town, and certainly in the Middle Ages. And so his grandfather was secretary to the abbot of the monastery for something like 40 years, and he was also mayor for around 40 years. So he no doubt got moved to the new cemetery, but his grandson did not.
Yeah, that's interesting. What was Unkel and Siegburg, Burg, what were they known for?
Siegburg,
wine?
It was known for weapons manufacturer for Hitler. That's one thing. So it got bombed during World War II, and a bomb mistakenly went right through the roof of the church,
wow.
the chapel of the monastery. So, of course, that was the capstone, the apex of the community, and a bomb would just have to land there, I would think, if you were dropping bombs. One would automatically sail right through that area.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that other than that, I don't know what Siegburg's main industry was before World War II, nor do I know what it is now.
Yeah.
It's a prosperous little town, but it's a relatively small town. Well, I'm thinking what kind of town it would be comparable to. Utica, maybe? And Utica probably would be about the size of Siegburg.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, that's not a, you know, that's a city. That's a decent-sized city, Utica. And it's, you know, it's on, you know, I always think of Utica as being on your way to Syracuse. Right,
mm-hmm.
So it's from Albany to Syracuse, you'll hit Utica first, and that's not to downplay it, but and then you know in one Syracuse, it's Rochester. They call them the throughway cities, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and I don't know if you heard that term, but you know, if you go up the throughway, you hit Albany, you know, and Troy right next to it, and Schenectady, and then you know, Utica, Syracuse, Rochester, Buffalo, And, you know.
Exactly.
You know, so those are your throughway cities. Kind of interesting. Anyway, it's always fascinating to talk about our friend Pfefferkorn. And somehow, some way, we got to get some more information on him. It's a shame. It's a shame that that these folks don't realize what a gem they have in him. Maybe they do, but they're not public relations people either. They've inherited their great uncle's lack of his humility, you know, or his lack of promotion, his lack of Mark Twainism or Dollyism. And
right. Yes.
Well, listen, thank you very much. Stay safe. And hopefully it's getting better. I'm just worried about Texas. I just think you guys opened a little too quickly, and I hope people don't get too cavalier. But who am I to say? I'm not a medical person, and I just.
Yeah, well, I agree there. I really do. I think especially Texas has, I think Georgia is even worse than Texas. But Texas is bad enough. A bunch of us who are in Democratic cities like Austin and San Antonio are still keeping our staying in shelter and wearing our masks and being very cautious. So I recommend that for everybody in the country right now, or in the world for that matter, until this whole thing dies down, if it ever will. We may have to wait for a vaccine before we can resume normal life.
This is—it's certainly not a 40-yard dash; it's a marathon, and we have to be diligent. And just because your governor, regardless of what state you're listening in, even though your governor says it's okay, doesn't mean you have to listen. And you could
that's right.
Listen.
Yeah, it's up to the individual.
Right, no doubt about it. Dr. Florence Byham-Weinberg, thank you very much once again for being here, and I look forward to speaking to you again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've always enjoyed these sessions with you, Frank.
Dr. Florence Byham-Weinberg has been our very special guest, and I will say right back at you to that last comment, and I can't wait to tell everyone where to see the documentary on her. It's wonderful. And she's the author of 11 books, and four of them have Pfefferkorn as a detective. And who else better than Pfefferkorn, now that we know about him, would make a great detective in those novels. And an amazing lady. The only thing I could say is binge listen to everything we've done. Her plots for her novels are just phenomenal. And buy the books, Amazon.com and Borders and Barnes & Noble, everywhere. And everyone out there, thank you very much for listening. Stay safe. And again, Dr. Florence Byham-Weinberg has been our very special guest. We'll see you all next time on Breaking It Down.